Welcome to episode 42 of Leading People with me, Jerry Murray. This episode is brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu. That's widecircle.eu. December the 9th, 2022 was Global Anti-Corruption Day. Whether it was a coincidence or not, raids took place on the homes of several people in Brussels, including a prominent member of the European Parliament. They're now facing charges of corruption and money laundering. It's estimated that corruption costs the EU economy hundreds of billions of euros per year, representing up to 6% of EU GDP lost in tax revenue and investment. In the UK, there are ongoing questions about how contracts for supplies were awarded during the COVID pandemic, leading to an investigation being launched into the business affairs of a member of the House of Lords. And in recent weeks, we witnessed the collapse of FTX, one of the biggest crypto businesses, leading to fraud charges for its founder. Events such as these have led to many people asking, how could this happen? Unfortunately, corruption is rampant in many sectors of society, as this week's guest, Richard Bistrong, explains. One day in 2007, Richard received a call from the US Department of Justice, which was to dramatically change the course of his life. He was subsequently indicted on corruption charges. Despite a plea deal that involved helping the investigators build a case against those at the top of his organization who encouraged or turned a blind eye to the corruption, Richard ended up in a US federal prison camp for 14 and a half months. However, rather than letting this negatively impact him, he decided to take what he learned from his experiences and reinvent himself. Upon his release, he created a consultancy business advising organizations on how to prevent corruption. And this has included creating award-winning anti-bribery, ethics and compliance e-learning videos for companies such as MasterCard. So, you might be asking, what's all this got to do with leading people? Well, actually, quite a lot. There's a saying that the fish rots from the head. And during our conversation, Richard highlights the responsibility that leaders bear for such practices in their organizations and provides valuable advice for anyone who finds themselves or knows of someone exposed to such risks. It's a fascinating story with lots of lessons for all of us. So let's dive right in. Richard Bistrong, welcome to the show.
Jerry, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So, Richard, we connected a little while ago through a mutual acquaintance via, I think, LinkedIn or whatever. We started to get to know each other a little bit. For our listeners out there, who, after all, this program is all about the listeners, maybe give us a little bit of background. You've got a very interesting background, I think you'd like to share with our listeners. And how did you get to the world you're in today, where you're working in the world of ethics and compliance, et cetera? But I believe there's quite an interesting story on how you got there. And there were several, I usually ask my guests about, was there an epiphany moment? Well, I think yours goes down as a pretty profound epiphany moment. So off you go.
So I'll share with you an abbreviated version of my journey from corruption to compliance. So my career was in international sales, traveling all over the world, 250 days a year overseas, living in the United Kingdom for part of that time. So this was a global defense manufacturer making armored vehicles, armored vests, riot control equipment. So there was a lot of interaction with public officials and what we often call in the world of business, third parties. Sometimes they're intermediaries, agents, or sometimes they're better known as fixers. And that was for 10 years. And I was certainly exposed to a lot of corruption and bribery risk, which I think the World Economic Forum estimates that 3 to 5% of global production is siphoned off to corruption. And this is also a story about personal accountability. So as we continue to dive deeper into this, Jerry, just to be clear, the decisions that we'll talk about were no one's fault but my own. With that said, I came into contact with a lot of corruption and corruption risk. And not a surprise, in 2007, it all caught up with me, with the United States and United Kingdom regulators. And when I got that, my epiphany moment was a call from the Department of Justice in 2007 that I was the target of a criminal investigation. Right. So my philosophy toward that call was, I did it, and I'm not going to put up a novel defense and try to get the government's evidence thrown out. I cooperated for 5 years with the United States and United Kingdom authorities. And at the end of that 5 year of cooperation, I was ultimately sentenced for my own crimes, which were bribing public officials in violation of U.S. and U.K. anti-bribery laws to win business, right? Because that's what these laws prevent. You can't inappropriately and illegally influence people's decisions to win or keep business. Uh-huh. I served 14 and a half months in a U.S. federal prison and returned home in December of 2013. And that's when I started taking a deep dive into our world of ethics and compliance. And Jerry, there's no shortage of well-resourced, well-educated providers in this field of ethics, anti-bribery, and compliance. We've got law firms, forensic firms, advisory firms. But what I didn't see, Jerry, was anyone talking about the what actually happens out there.
Right.
What is it like to be tasked with aggressive commercial success in volatile parts of the world where we know bribery and corruption is prevalent? What does that feel like? What does that look like to feel the pressure to succeed and the pressure to comply? So in 2014, I started talking about it.
Right. And I guess that is the unique take you have on it, because a lawyer can talk about and tell you what the law says, etc. But you can actually get up in front of an audience and actually relate to any individual in that audience who might be involved in commercial work in those areas and say, you know what, guys, I know what it's like to be sitting there, and I also know what it's like to fall into the trap of. So you're actually able, I guess, very able to get those people to identify with you, and you identify with them. Would that be true?
That would be true. And I can appreciate, and I lean on a lot of behavioral research, including a number of books that talk about some of the biases that we experience, and to try to get commercial teams comfortable that, and this goes back to your conversation with Andy Lancaster about Amy Edmondson's work, that it's okay to be confident, competent, and confused.
Right.
It's okay to feel that you're in the middle of competing corporate pressures between the pressure to succeed and the pressure to comply. The most important element of that pressure is not to take it on yourself and not to think that you as an individual are there to deconflict this tension when you have an ethics and compliance team that's there to help you make principled decisions in a very complex and volatile world.
Yeah. And of course, Andy Lancaster, the podcast was all about making mistakes, but also being able to forgive and to see mistakes as just part of a journey sometimes. Now, I guess your own mistake, if you want to call it that, was quite an ominous one that most people wouldn't want to have to deal with the consequences of. Today, you're the CEO of, you call the company Frontline Anti-Bribery, and I know you've been involved in authoring or co-authoring some publications now, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do, what you and your organization do, and actually maybe answer this question, why should anybody take somebody like you seriously who's actually been on that other side of the red line, as you call it? So maybe you can unpack that for us a little bit and explain what you're doing and how we should take you seriously.
Well, it's a great question. I have a master's degree in foreign policy, but I clearly didn't ace my ethics class, given that I ended up in federal prison.
Yeah.
So I'm not here to preach ethics. I'm the last person that should be doing that.
Right.
But what I can do, Jerry, is share, you know, to quote a U.S. Iconic movie, right? The good, bad, and the ugly.
Yeah.
About what happens out there. And to share my experience with transparency, because while being a law enforcement undercover cooperator might be unique, my 10-year experience as a sales executive facing these pressures and facing these risks is not all that unique.
No.
So my responsibility is to be transparent, open, and honest about what happened and how I think if we listen to the people in the field that face these risks, we can better calibrate our ethics and compliance messages and initiatives to these real world risks. And I can appreciate and I embrace, Jerry, that some people may discard or dilute or discount that message because it comes from someone, let's call it what it is, words matter, an ex-felon. And I leave that up to the individual.
Right.
So my responsibility is to share what happened, to do so openly, honestly, and then I will let the individual make the decision if they think it's helpful to the real world risks that they face.
Right. So one of the reasons why I was really interested in getting you on this show was this is all about leading people. And we know that leaders lead by example. And we also probably know that a lot of these practices, whether they get an affirmative, like what would you say, people can turn a blind eye to it, or it can get a silent endorsement, right, from somebody in an organization. And you know, even though leaders might like to think that they're above all this, many of them know what stuff is going on in their organizations at some level. And so I guess I was really interested in the fact that, you know, you have a message for leaders, the people who are leading organizations, but you also have a message for people being led who, you know, if they are not comfortable in an organizational setting where these practices may be happening, to know what to do, right? So I think you're doing a lot of talking and workshops with people. Is that right, Richard, on this topic?
That's correct, Jerry. And one of the more encouraging signals that I'm getting, which leads me to believe we're heading in the right direction, is where when I first started my practice circa 2015 and 2016, I was talking mostly to the Richard Bistrongs out there, regional sales teams or global sales teams. But now, Jerry, I'm talking to business leaders. I'm talking to the C-suite. I'm talking to the board. I'm talking to either regional leadership or global leadership, because this is really about leading people. Because if you look at an organization, and if the only people who are talking about ethical and sustainable business practices are the legal ethics and compliance teams, that sounds like a support function. But when you have your CEO and your general managers and your group VPs talking about ethical expectations through the voice of business, through the corporate narrative, not just the legal narrative, it sounds like at our organization, doing what's right isn't a legal responsibility, it's everyone's responsibility. So a lot of my workshops lately have been sensitivity and awareness workshops for business leaders, getting them to appreciate the power of their voice when it comes to ethics and integrity, because I don't think they really do.
Yeah, okay. So, taking what you just said, one of the things I think might be interesting for our listeners is tell our listeners about the language of bribery. You talked about words mattering earlier. Tell our listeners about the language of bribery, because it might surprise them in an organization.
So the language of bribery, in involves a lot of different interesting words, except bribe. So I've heard bribes called tolls, making people happy, sunshine payments. Jerry, I don't know why, but for some reason, food is a favorite. Cakes, candies, chocolates, marzipan. There was a recent case involving a financial services firm where someone emailed another co-conspirator asking, when are you going to wire my 25 million chickens? Okay. Now, there's a little bit of humor in that, but the serious part of it is it leads to a little bit of moral fading. So yeah. When I'm out there in the field and I'm hearing one of my business partners talking about making people happy, as opposed to saying, Richard, just so you know, I'm participating in transnational crime, it makes it feel a little bit more morally acceptable. It doesn't sort of challenge your own integrity the way the real word, which is bribe, crime, criminal behavior, would get one to push back. So I think these words are very dangerous in that they can lead us to a sense of complacency and that moral fading, yet another bias.
Yeah, okay.
I'm still waiting to hear the word bribe, Jerry, and I'm talking now 20 years into this. That's still the word I haven't heard.
Yeah, it's probably because, as you say, everybody knows what that means, and it would be very uncomfortable to be using that term. So these are the types of words that are used. And, of course, the challenge for a lot of executives is once you start going into the international arena, because I've worked in the international arena myself, there are so many parts of the world. Yeah, many parts of the world are conformed to Western norms that, you know, and they're kind of, even some accounting systems are governed by American rules or British rules or whatever. And then there's other parts of the world where you're there and all of a sudden you're starting to pick up that business doesn't get done quite the same way. And then that can be quite an uncomfortable situation. I've never been in the sales role in those environments myself. I've only ever been there as part of a corporate team. But if I was a salesperson and then I begin to realize that there's hints being given or, you know, let's say code language being used, etc., it must be a very uncomfortable place to be. But you've been there, so you sort of kind of go, oh, okay, now I understand what's going on. Or maybe somebody gave you a nudge and said, actually, Richard, you know, this is, you just to stay tuned, this will work out for you. So what would you advise somebody who finds themselves in that type of situation? Remember, they're maybe on a business trip for 2 weeks and they're out there in the field and now they're confronted with this kind of thing. How do you deal with it?
I call it an ethical wind tunnel. You feel like, okay, what my company's expectations are from an ethics and compliance perspective is the opposite of how my competitors are working in this field. And that can lead to a very, you know, hazardous sense of, if I don't do this, I can't win. If I don't do this, I can't keep up. And worse is those people back at the home office, they don't know what I'm up against. They don't know what it's like out here. And there's no way I can meet my commercial objectives without compromising integrity. So how do you deal with that? Goes back to leadership. So if you know that exists, if you know you have a sales team working in a region that has a reputation for corruption risk, and there are so many different indicators that we can use, including Transparency International. So there are no secrets here. Mm-hmm. And they are not calling you. Those teams are not calling for help. They're not calling to say, we're struggling. We need support in how we're supposed to succeed while doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. Then leaders, business leaders, need to be calling them and saying, look, we're not hearing from you, and we should be hearing from you. That's not necessarily a good signal. And this is what Amy Edmondson, in an iconic chapter in her iconic book, calls dangerous silence.
Yes.
Where no one's calling for help, and we're not calling to ask how things are going. And this is a situation that can lead to, well, no news must mean good news. And then if we're not careful, as in my case, for 10 years, bad behavior can really hide well behind good performance. So if you know the danger is there, you know that people are in an ethical wind tunnel, why not proactively reach out to them and say, and Amy lists the questions in her book, just nice open-ended questions. What are you up against? How can we help? What's going on out there? Because we don't know what you're up against unless you tell us about it.
No. And at some level then, it is responsibility of the C-suite. And in a way, they have to send down reassurance to the field that if you're up against these factors, right, we give you a sort of communication channel to talk about it, or to at least have some way to acknowledge this. And maybe, I think you quote in somewhere about a memo from one of your top people that said the sales figures, if we don't get our sales figures this year, we're in trouble or whatever. It's those messages which can throw oil on that fire, aren't they? For a guy in the front line, because he has to know that it's okay to not make the sales figure if it means that he would compromise his integrity himself, his own integrity, but also that of the organization, doesn't he?
Exactly. And that message, it was in an email that said, if we don't make our numbers next quarter, this came from the vice president of sales to a sales team. If we don't make our numbers next quarter, it's going to be hell on earth for all of us. What does that mean? Think of the power of that sentence. And it was ultimately entered into evidence in a prosecution agreement against a certain company. Because think about the cultural implications of that statement to a sales team working in a high-risk region. That means do what you need to do, and if that means taking a shortcut, take it. That's the unspoken message.
Right. Now, you said the phrase, the power of that sentence. I like a lot of phonological ambiguity, etc. There is the power of the other sentence, which is when you, I think you even spoke about it yourself, you know, those 5 years leading up to when you were cooperating, and you ultimately probably knew that you were going to end up at some stage having to what they say, do time. I mean, what is the power of that sentence on a human being?
The power of that is, you can take an individual that has signed compliance affidavits, representations, has been through ethics and compliance and anti-bribery training. But when you look at that voice of business, because who are we turning to for direction? We're turning to the people who we work for. Right? The people who have a say in our performance evaluations and our objectives, they're the ones that we're listening to. So sometimes those can be very loud, yet unspoken messages that this is what it takes to succeed around here. And that voice of business can overpower even the best ethics and compliance and risk platform. So that, again, returns to this theme of, you can have a wonderful and well-intentioned ethics and compliance program, but are your business peers and your business leaders, particularly mid-level managers, are they taking it seriously? Because when we look at those mid-level managers, they have their hands on the volume controls of two different levers. One is get the business done, and the other is the importance of how business gets done. And those mid-level managers are who people are turning to for spoken and unspoken clues and cues as to how things get done around here.
Right. And the, you see, the other sentence I was referring to was the one when the judge hands it down to you and says, Richard, you, because that sentence is, you know, a very explicit sentence, right? In when we say you get sentenced for a crime and you know, ignoring or having these other sentences about the pressure that comes down the line, those are words. But when somebody says to you, we're going to put you away for a period of time, that must be a tough sentence to have to process in one's world. And I guess that's somewhere that most people, you'd say to most people out there, you don't want to be in that chair when that happens.
You don't. And I remember my sentencing judge said to the something to the effect of, Richard, I could actually let you go home today. I have the discretion to give you a non-custodial sentence, but people who face the same risks and pressures that you face need to understand that even if they cooperate with law enforcement, they're going to go to prison, right? That's how we promote criminal deterrence. So we said, yes, you are entitled to a discount. I could sentence you to 5 years, but I'm not. I'm going to sentence you to 18 months, of which I serve 14 and a half. But he's absolutely right, Jerry. And one of the messages that I'm trying to send out is you don't have to go to prison to understand that you do face competing corporate objectives, but that you never have to take that into your own hands. You don't have to go to prison to have that epiphany.
Coming up, Richard explains why ambiguity is the enemy of ethics, integrity, and responsibility. The types of situations that can cause someone to take ethical risks and how to prepare your people for dealing with such situations. He goes on to talk about what he calls open secrets and much more. So let's get back to the conversation. Now, somewhere else you said ambiguity is the enemy of ethics, integrity, and responsibility. Now, I'm sure listeners are curious about what's in that statement. So what do you mean by ambiguity is the enemy of ethics, integrity, and responsibility?
Well, there's a top end and a bottom end of it. So the top side is the voice of leadership. The if we don't make our numbers, it's going to be hell on earth for everyone. That's ambiguity. What does hell on earth mean?
Yes.
Right. So that's leadership ambiguity. But there's also ambiguity in how we process messages from the people who we're working with. So, for example, there was an organization where there was a particular shipment that was getting held up in customs, which was an overseas order. That very often happens. There is a customs official who's going to hold up your entire contract, and those goods are going to sit on the dock until someone takes care of that customs official.
Yeah.
So the third party says, look, we can't get our order to the end user because it's sitting at the customs dock.
Yeah.
And the company employee says, well, you know, we're going to risk losing the order, our letter of credit. We need to get those goods moving. What are we going to do? And the local representative in that country said, don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
What does take care of it mean?
I think it probably means a brown envelope exchanges hands somewhere along the line, if we're being all honest here, right? But something happens and it's ambiguous, right? I'll take care of it.
I think you're very close, Jerry, because that email string was entered into evidence. So the that's where the company employee had a responsibility to ask the tough questions and to say, do not do anything till I understand what's going on there. And then you can unpack that email with your team and to say, we need to freeze this process till we understand what's happening.
But you can understand, like, I mean, that employee in the local country could also have a client screaming at him or her saying, where's my order? You promised it to me, as you say, having all sorts of commercial consequences and thinking, I need a fixer. I need somebody who's going to free that order up. Because often it can be, it won't be small cheese, as they say. It'll be probably significant amount of money tied up in that order. And people might be surprised out there, but there are still corrupt customs officials around this world, aren't they? Who basically top up their income by holding up shipments.
So that's such a real world dilemma. And if we really think about it, you could have multi-million-dollar contracts being held up by that customs official, to where a company employee might think, I've got a big bonus riding on this, especially if it's within a particular fiscal quarter. For what this customs official wants, I could pay this out of my pocket. It's a reasonable investment to move this thing along. And there are two psychological biases that come into play here. One is called loss aversion, where we will take greater risk not to lose something than to win something. And I've been through this, Jerry. I've already won that order. My boss is expecting it. The financial department's expecting it. And now I need to get it to the last step. So I don't want to lose something I've already won. So I'll take more risk to win, to not to lose that. And the other is escalation commitment. So the closer we are to the finish line, it's called escalation of commitment, apologies. The closer we are to the finish line, the more likelihood there is that we will take risks to get there. So I'm just one step away from realizing this big sale, and now I've got a customs official standing between me and success. I will take greater risk just to get to the finish line. And that's why sometimes there can be a false sense of complacency that risk goes down as we go through a sales process, when actually risk can go up as we go through a sales process.
Okay. Now, I hope this is not making any of our listeners uncomfortable out there, but even if you are listeners, if you have had encounters like this, maybe some of you can identify with what we're talking about, or would prefer not to have these encounters in the first place. How do you go about making the difficult issues discussable then? Because we've talked about the ambiguity and how this is a real-world phenomenon in many parts of the world, and it doesn't even have to be international business. It could be happening domestically in some countries. But how do you make these difficult issues discussable then in an organizational context?
I think part of it is having these discussions about risk and ethical dilemmas when there's not a crisis at hand. So there's another iconic book called Giving Voice to Values by Mary Gentile. And what she addresses in her research is the more we're talking about inevitable ethical dilemmas when there's not a crisis at hand, maybe we have an ethical dilemma workshop and we anonymize something that happened in an organization and ask the questions, what would you do? You know, this happened here. How would you respond? And the more that we do that, the more likelihood there is that we will act on our values when that crisis does present itself, or when that dilemma does present itself. So leaving people to figure out risk while they are in the middle of it, being on the spot, not being prepared, does not lead to great outcomes. But if we know that these challenges are out there, why not talk about them? And the more we're talking about them in the safe zone, the more likelihood, number one, that we will act on our values. And number two, if we're unsure when it happens, we will reach out for support. So I think that's how we make difficult issues discussable. It's just by talking about them.
Yeah, and actually, one of my earlier podcasts was with Craig Weber on conversational capacity, and he's done a lot of work on how to talk about stuff, but in a way that reduces and minimizes the defensiveness that can kick in around this. And I was also, I'm a big fan of adaptive leadership, and I was going through some of Ron Heifetz and Linsky's work the other day, and they talk about, you know, this concept of the adaptive challenge. And one of the big challenges in organizations is the gap between beliefs and behavior, or beliefs and action, you know, where here's what we say our beliefs are, but actually here's what's really happening. And this notion that, you know, if you really want to understand what an organization or a person or a leader stands for, you can stop paying attention to what they say, but start paying attention to what they do. And you're going to learn a lot more about what the real values are in an organization. So how do you talk to that now? Here's the interesting thing. We discount the future. So everybody's sitting there going, it won't happen to me. And anyway, that's something that might happen in 2 years' time. Why do we need to pay attention to it now? So let's unpack a bit of that now. How do you get this dissonance between the value statements and the behavior? How do you address that? And how do you kind of make it more real in the moment rather than people saying, well, it's no problem at the moment. Why would we need to bother?
Ooh, that's a lot to unpack, but that's a great challenge. It reminds me, I think it's Shine's work on organizational capacity in terms of spoken and unspoken messages, what leaders are saying, what leaders are doing, and is that aligned? And we've seen some really great organizations with very strong ethics and integrity platforms get into trouble because they're not aligned. And this often happens in low-risk places of the world where companies in Sweden, companies in Singapore, which have wonderful reputations for good governance and transparency, might have the belief, well, everybody behaves like we do. This is a wonderful culture in our society. We'll tell that to the people and the team that's working in Uzbekistan that is tasked with dramatic and rapid commercial success in what we know is a high-risk region. And I'm not picking on Uzbekistan other than to say the people that are going to succeed are not the people that are working in those countries. They're the people in the field.
Yeah.
So what are we saying to them? And assuming that they're going to have the same cultural approach as the people in the home office, you know, that's not fair to them because they're up against much different risks. And there's another book, this is more recent, as you can tell, I consume these books on behavior and culture and ethics. It's called The Behavioral Code. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of meeting one of the co-authors in Amsterdam. And what he shares is, we think we are much better predictors of how we will respond to an ethical challenge than we really are when that happens in the moment. We are very poor predictors and very poor self-indicators of how we're going to respond to risk. And that goes back to, and this is something I'm quite passionate about, Jerry, there's a difference between training people and preparing people.
Right.
You can have people watch all the ethics and compliance videos you'd like. Does that prepare them for the risks that they face? Because corruption risk in South America is much different than corruption risk in the Middle East. And putting them through a compliance library is not going to be helpful to them.
No. You remind me a little bit of Dan Ariely's work on where he's done experiments where he gets people a bit
emotionally excited, and he says all judgment, and I think he does it around safe sex or something like that. But he said the whole risk factors just go out the window, he said, and they've replicated it in other contexts. So depending on the situation a person finds themselves in, what they tell you they'll do, that's his work on predictably irrational. What they tell you they will do rationally actually goes out the window when they're put in certain contexts where all sorts of hormones and other things get active and stuff like that. Now, I wanted to get, before we get to the end, I wanted to get to this whole, the whole concept of whistleblowing has been getting media attention in recent years. And what advice do you have for anybody out there who perceives that some corrupt practices might be taking place in their organization? Because it could be very uncomfortable to know about it by turning a blind. I think you actually said somewhere, the fact that you had acknowledged some of this stuff was going on would also implicate you in the crime by knowing it without even necessarily being active. Is that correct? So what if somebody's out there listening to this? I mean, I don't know who's listening to every episode, but what if somebody's out there now listening to this going, I think I suspect something like this is going on. What advice would you give them about how to approach it?
And here we're coming up against the dynamic of what I often call open secrets. Mm-hmm. So those are the things in organizations that many people know about, but no one's speaking up about. So to one of our listeners today who might know of an open secret, I think there are a couple of things to consider. Number one, for most multinationals, Jerry, there are multiple channels to communicate wrongdoing. From anonymous channels to reporting channels to whether it's through the business line of communication or an ethics and compliance hotline. So depending on your level of comfort, we are all the guardians and gatekeepers of not only our personal values, but our corporate values.
Right.
And I think that's a responsibility we need to take quite seriously. So if you know of wrongdoing, I recently wrote an article on what to do when your boss asks you to do something unethical. And yeah. Five strategies on how to deal with that. But at the end of the day, you need to deal with that. So what I would suggest is, look at the reporting channel that you are most comfortable with as an individual, because as you stated, the culture part of it is embracing your role as an ambassador of your personal and corporate values, but also, and we have seen this in anti-bribery and corruption scandals, depending on what you might do, if you know that activity is going on, and you do not speak up about it, you might think of yourself as just a bystander where you might actually be looked at by the regulators as a co-conspirator.
Right.
So a little bit of warning there.
And an even slightly more uncomfortable one, advice would you give anybody out there who's listening to this who might already be slightly compromised or have somebody in their immediate family orbit, for example, whom they suspect has been compromised? What I mean, because just after what you've just said, where does that leave you if you feel, well, I've bent the rules a bit, or I have a partner who's been bending the rules? How do you go about that?
That might be the million euro or the million dollar question. So this is the challenge of how do we course correct even after we might have engaged or witnessed wrongdoing.
Yeah.
Because the natural inclination is I'm going to bury it and hope that I never hear or see of it again. Mm. And the only thing I would encourage our listeners to do is to appreciate that course correction is what needs to be. That should be the line of action. And most organizations that I work with send out the message that even if you've done something wrong, We will try to keep it, and I think this goes back to what Andy Lancaster was sharing in Start Talking About Mistakes. We will try to keep it in the range of understandable and forgivable. That's not to say you're going to get a pay raise, but we will try to understand why you thought that was a good decision. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a learning lesson for the entire organization for people who face similar risks. Now, we might have to reverse a transaction. We might have to try to put toothpaste back in the tube, and that could be costly to everyone, including you.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, and this is what Amy shares, we're going to try to learn from it. Whereas, if we find out about wrongdoing, and you haven't brought it to us, but we discovered it, it's automatically unforgivable. And there's no chance for recovery. So when I think back to some of my early decisions going back to 1997 when I first started this role, so now I'm aging myself, Jerry, but okay. if I go back to some of those early decisions, if I would have come back and said to the company, listen, I think I messed up here, here's what happened. Again, I don't think I would have received a pay increase, but I think we could have kept it in the range of regretful but understandable.
Yeah. And I guess there's also the possibility of talking in confidence to somebody in the legal profession to get an assessment of what your options are if you do believe you've slightly compromised yourself.
Correct. There is, you know, this is not a call for, nor am I in a position to say you're going to get amnesty. Obviously, depending on the level of transgression, yes, I mean, at some point, if on the more extreme side, you would definitely need to seek counsel before deciding anything. So I don't want that to be misinterpreted in any way.
Final few minutes, Richard shares some practical things that any of us could do to ensure ourselves or others are not being compromised, and he has a very unique special offer for you.
Getting to the end, the last few minutes, and I know we've discussed you're going to make a little offer for people in a few minutes, but first, before we get to that, what advice or tips would you like to leave our listeners with today, either whether they're leaders or employees? Because you write a lot about it, Richard, and so you've published a lot of stuff over the years. But if you could distill it down to maybe three things that people could reflect upon after this conversation we've just had, maybe just some things that you think are the difference that could make the difference between somebody being able to deal with this kind of thing now and never having to go down the route you ended up going down in terms of doing the stuff and then ending up just having to serve some prison time and et cetera. So what would you say to people out there, particularly if they're leaders in organizations, what could they do to starting after this, to whether to just check what's going on or to change something?
So I think this returns to a theme that we've talked about earlier, proactive outreach. Not everyone in an organization faces the same level of risk. So it doesn't take a lot to risk map. These are the folks that are in much more challenging situations and regions and roles. Let's reach out to them. Even if they're not calling us, or maybe particularly if they're not calling us, let's take some mini pulses. Right? We don't have to do a global risk survey or a global culture survey, but I'll tell you what, we've got 15 people that are out there in a very difficult region. Let's stay a little bit closer to them. And that doesn't always mean, especially in this hybrid environment, it doesn't mean a fancy webinar or training schedule. It could just mean picking up the phone and calling someone and showing a duty of care and saying, look, we want to make sure that you're not left with a regulatory issue after, you know, our current supply chain or health crisis has passed. And people are going to appreciate that outreach. And it also helps to align not only the risks that are stubborn and that we know people face, but Jerry, we're in such a dynamic world, it helps to understand what are the emerging risks? What are the things that we're not thinking about? And who knows that better than the people in the field? I think the other message is, let's get back to that voice of business. Let's get our business leaders, the people joining us today, to appreciate the power of their voice. And when they're sharing the importance of how business gets done, when they're getting ready to stamp their fist on the table, talking about getting the business done, it just has such an impact on people's behavior as appreciating that here, ethical and sustainable business practices, well, that's how things get done.
Yeah. And I guess now at the end of this conversation, they have a resource, so you could also share this podcast or check out a lot of your other work, because I know you've got a well-resourced website where people can find out more about your writings and your messages and watch some of your videos, or get you in for a chat. Eh? I guess you wouldn't refuse that if they are prepared to pay you to come in and give a talk on this, spend a day with them and explain to them and interact with their key people. I guess that would work very well, wouldn't it?
It would. And even more informally, I'm always up for a compliance coffee.
Okay, that's a new one. Compliance coffee. Very good. So what's next for Richard Bistrong?
So in partnership with MasterCard, we're getting ready to launch our third anti-bribery and corruption video. The last two that we have produced have won awards for corporate training and communication. So we're extremely excited about the launch of the third one, which is called Ordinary Situations, Extraordinary Risk. So that's in terms of rating what's exciting out there, this new MasterCard video is really, really very, very interesting, and we're looking forward to that.
All right. Is that going out globally? Because MasterCard have their European headquarters just down the road here. And I happen to still know some people who work there. But is this a global video or is it just for the U.S.?
So they are global videos. They are subtitled. I think we're up to 13 or 14 different languages. And they are licensed by companies all over the world, Jerry.
Right. So by the time this podcast airs, I guess these videos will be well out there and people can go and check them out on various platforms, I guess.
Absolutely. There is a process to request an evaluation. So you can watch the whole video and to think about if it would be helpful to complement your existing ethics and compliance initiatives.
Okay. So I'm going to put some links in the show note to your website, et cetera. But how else can people best get in contact with you? Like LinkedIn, or is that something you're open to people connecting with you on LinkedIn?
Jerry, according to my children, I'm overactive on social media. So LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, all under Richard Bistrong. I have a LinkedIn newsletter that's now coming into its first year. So I always invite people, you can find it on my LinkedIn profile, to subscribe to the newsletter, which is very informal, conversational, just like our discussion today. So I would say yes on social media.
Okay. And before we came on air, you had a little offer for people. How many people, you said, if they contact you on LinkedIn, what was the offer you're going to give them?
So why don't we round it out to a dozen? And for the first dozen people that connect with me on LinkedIn and maybe send me a message that they heard the podcast, I am happy to give them, provide them with a PDF of a series of book reviews that I do as part of a My Compliance Library column, because I know that not everyone has time to read all these wonderful books that we've been talking about, but we'd like to know what we should be reading. So hopefully these book reviews might provide some value in understanding the perspective of these authors, and if someone wants to go ahead and read the whole work. How's that?
That sounds like a fantastic offer and an opportunity for anybody who wants to dig deeper into the subject. So, Richard, thanks again on behalf of myself and the listeners for sharing your insights, tips, and wisdom with us all today. Wishing you lots of success.
Thank you, Jerry. It's been an absolute honor and pleasure to chat with you today. And thank you for everyone for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. You will find details of what we covered in the show with links, etc., in the show notes. Please share your key takeaways from today's guest and let your friends and colleagues know about the podcast. Oh, and if there's a particular author or leading thinker you'd like me to interview, just get in touch and I'll do my best to get them on the show. This episode was brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu. That's widecircle.eu. Until next time.